Welcome to Meet the Writers. I'm Georgina Godwin. Born in Limerick, Ireland, my guest today is the author of 10 works of fiction. His novel, The Keepers of Truth, won the Irish Novel of the Year Award and was nominated for the Booker Prize, the first for crime. When he isn't writing with what The Independent calls a style so arrestingly visual it hijacks the reader's concentration, he runs incredible distances. He's won the Everest, Sahara and North Pole marathons. These days, he runs 70 to 100 miles every week. Michael Collins, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thanks very much for having me.
Now, The Death of All Things Seen, that's your new book, starts on the eve of the financial crisis. And you've previously said that your novels are driven by issues of social justice and a moral obligation to workers. And I wondered where that obligation comes from. If we could perhaps go back to your early life.
Sure. I think probably I see everything through a political context. I'm 52, so growing up in the 70s, the struggle between Northern Ireland or Ireland and England was ever present. So everything went through that political lens, watching the TV, watching the relationship between the two countries. And then, of course, we were in an economic quagmire there. So everything seemed to be centred around politics when I was young. And then, of course, the history of Ireland going back further. So I think that registered with me as a young person. And as then I moved into writing later in life, that was the primary concern.
Mm-hmm. You talk about moving into writing, but you have severe dyslexia. So how does that work?
I read very slowly, but I think I read in a very conscious way. So it's very slow, very few books would I read in a year. So when I look at it, I think style, pace, everything is very apparent if you're reading with your finger on the lines. Stop at a page, look back and see what actually happened. So in terms of at school, it was a struggle. But I think overall, my understanding of language, and even when I do computer programming as well, because it's all done at such a glacial pace, that when I see it, I will actually understand it. So I think it's a benefit in the kind of long run. And of course, with computers now, you can type and the thing will autocorrect and do all those things that would have been kind of onerous in the past before you submit stuff to people. But when I was young, if you couldn't spell properly and things were all over the page, it was very difficult to advance in school. So I relied more on running and sports to get me out of Ireland to America.
Right. And you then took up a scholarship at a kind of Rust Belt college. Tell me about that.
So you go to the World Championships, a variety of American universities offer you scholarships. I took Notre Dame, Fighting Irish is what it was called. So sight unseen, I arrived out there, Catholic school. And I think I used running and sports. You'd think that I care about sports, but I don't actually care about sports. I used it as a means to get out of Ireland. Got there, spent 2 years out of a four-year college running. Was fourth in the nationals for a second-year student. That was good. And then I realised that there was an element of exploitation at play there. So as a foreigner, I went up to the priest and said, look, I'm getting nothing out of this really, other than just being a kind of greyhound for you. And a very benevolent priest said to me, what do you want to do? And I said, I'd like to study and, you know, here's some of the kind of lackings that I have. And he said, OK, just don't run and move into academics. So that was sort of a calculated decision. I went over to a lot of glitzy universities, University of Florida and various things like that. I thought maybe the Catholic priest and things like that, that I'd be able to negotiate my way out of running. And I was able to.
And so what were you studying? What was driving you?
I think it was the first time where I read a lot of books and I began to understand that the context of where I'd come from and what I might be going back to in Ireland was all dealt with in books, social realism, Dickens, then American novels of the turn of the century. They were set in Chicago, The Jungle, Sinclair Lewis, Theodore Dreiser and a variety of things like this. I began to realise that if you really want to understand yourself or your culture, that actually books more than films or music, that there was a composite world that you could enter and negotiate and understand what was going on. Again, first and foremost for myself. So I did that for those 2 years. And then the last year of college, I took a writing course without ever wanting to be a writer. But just, as I said, I thought that was a good way to negotiate your own kind of psyche was through the short stories or a novel. And I came out the other end with a degree in engineering, computer engineering. But then my first love was writing. But of course, it's difficult to make a living in writing.
But the Booker longlisting must have absolutely made
no, it. No, shortlisting.
Don't downgrade it. But that must have made a big impact on your writing life. Your writing profile, at any rate.
Well, profile, yeah. I mean, I've not been back to Ireland or England. I mean, and I've always sequestered myself in small cities. And then I worked at Microsoft when that book came out. So I wrote it at night. Very little money. So, you know, it was more or less just a compunction to get something done. And it came out. I came here and then I was kind of gone. So You know, my relationship with writing and a public, a general public, is pretty minimal. I mean, they're always done first and foremost for myself, and you're here for a couple of days and then you're back home. So that milieu, it just doesn't really exist for me. The books and myself, are that relationship is the kind of primary concern, and showing up here or coming to another country or going to a festival is a very fleeting and passing thing. So I wouldn't consider myself a writer as such. You know, even with 10 books, it's like running. You know, you train for 4 months, you don't drink, you don't do anything, you prepare, and then the race is over. And, you know, you continue at a certain base level. And then with a book, it would be, 4 or 5 months of writing. And I would say that's the most I could give to a project with the kind of intensity of an athlete, and then leave it.
Mm. Now, you mentioned there that you worked for Microsoft, and I've seen a quote that you talk about witnessing the disconnection between what you produced and how you were paid. Just expand that a bit for us.
So, again, having grown up, and I wouldn't say in poverty in Ireland, but seeing just how hard people can work and there's no reward. When I went out there and I wrote short stories that were in New York and things like this, and you get a dollar a word, you go out there and all of a sudden, once the stock began to split, I mean, your income doubled in a day with a stock split. So when you begin to understand just how business works and the evaluation of markets and stock and things like this. Now, my real reaction to that was, this could kill me. You know, I'm in my early 30s, and to buy into this and to now begin to buy flashy cars and big houses was going to fundamentally destroy me. So I made a pact with myself that I would last up to the point where I didn't cash in the stock. And during that particular time, I began to write furiously. So I wrote The Keepers of the Truth, which was a homage to industrialism and the Rust Belt. And again, you could only make so much money as a factory worker. And there's a kind of limited sense of where you were going to go in life. And in conjunction with that, then I began serious long distance running, taking what I would consider a kind of postmodern pilgrimages of a 100-mile run on the weekend, leaving a Friday from work exhausted, and then spend 3 days running around various different volcanoes in the general vicinity to kind of take myself away from the lure. Not that I was really lured by it, but I wanted to have some point of distinction from what I thought was really aberrant. And that was the beginning of kind of hyper-capitalism. But I saw people, you know, who would buy themselves stuff, and when they were doubly wealthy, they felt they were worth it. And I could never kind of gel with that, that you could all of a sudden be twice as big, twice as strong, twice as wealthy. And I think that's one of the fundamental issues that has kind of plagued me as a writer, and even just as a kind of modern citizen, that disconnect between the rich and the poor.
Mm. And both those themes, that of wealth and of a journey, are things that come up in your new book, The Death of All Things Seen. So it starts on the eve of the financial crisis.
Right. So I mean, it's been 6 years since I wrote a book, and I really kind of wait for seminal moments. So I look back at that and realize that it all looked like it was going to collapse. And then everything kind of proceeded onwards or limped forward, but there was no kind of center. It says at a certain point in the book, no one jumped to their death. So in the 29 crash, there was a definitive sense of an end, and things did go very bad. I mean, people on food lines and things like this. So I kind of watched it to see, is this the end, or is there ever an end? And I think at that point, I had enrolled at Oxford in a creative writing course. I begged them to let me in, you know, to study modernism, postmodernism. And I began to see just how decentered and destructured everything is, that nothing ever breaks, but nothing ever gets fixed either. So it begins with a woman who's from a different era, where she sees everything in a straight line. She arrives, she drives down a street, she remembers everything in a very linear pattern. And then after that prologue, it breaks and it moves into the disjointed story of various different people in sexuality, children that are brought over from China, adopted. So a very fragmented existence. So I suppose the question for me was, which is more authentic, or which is better? The previous life, which we see in the book, is there's an element of deceit, and it wasn't as rosy as you would think. Mm. And then the kind of postmodern life looks very sad. But, that's the world we live in. And there's also, you know, apparent beauty in that. So the story moves on from the prologue of someone looking back to a kind of greater time.
Right. Now, the idea of a journey as redemption is also very much core to this.
Sure. I suppose I got into the road novel, or someone has maybe written one or two books, maybe the book after the book, and someone in France said, oh, the road novel that you're writing, the American road novel. And then I began to realise that all the books that I have that I think are successful do take place through movement, through kind of physical dislocation. And in this particular book, the fellow who's in an apartment, the central protagonist, is stuck in an apartment trying to figure something out. And it's only through the act of physical relocation and movement on the road does he begin to witness, again, the kind of apparent beauty or kind of struggle that people have. But he has to be out there in the world. And I think maybe that's the great thing about America, is not that there's great brain power, but there's enough fluidity of movement that you can get out and, you know, see the Deep South and understand a kind of conservative Christian. Then you can go Chicago and see another type of thing, and then go out to Microsoft where it's reconfigured as a kind of virtual world. So you can negotiate and travel through those different spheres if you want to. And I've always, again, I think being an immigrant and leaving, I've no attachment to one place. So all places are unique and interesting to me. And my kind of thing as a writer is to try to figure out what's the kind of psyche and place. They must have some relationship.
Mm-hmm. So, as you say, an immigrant born in Ireland, now living in America, the great American naturalist, that's something that appeals to you, doesn't it?
It does. You know, reading through Thoreau and Walden and Pond and all that type of stuff, I have a great sense of when I do run, I try to go back to a kind of primitivism where you're accountable for your own self. And so in this particular novel, I have a character who avoids the Vietnam War and goes north up to the kind of First Nations people. And, you know, I've done many journeys like that myself. Where my kids are homeschooled, and so we leave in a motor home, and then further beyond them, I'll go on these kind of long runs or 2-3 day trips by myself. And you know, I do connect with a sense of that everything is about yourself. You have to survive, you have to plan, you have to do things. And so when I did the research for this book, and I didn't do much research, but the Cours du Bois were runners of the woods. They were back in the time of the French fur trappers in Quebec, and so they would pack and they would learn how to pack and then leave for 4 or 5 months. And I remember reading that and going, geez, I'd love to be one of those people, because that's what I would love to do, is to be just abandoned for, you know, 4 or 5 months to just survive by myself. So trips to the Antarctic, trips to the South Pole, trips to Everest are always really, there's no real accompaniment with those things. It's up to yourself. And they kind of pick up the stragglers as they go, but there's no genuine help on those adventures.
So now I'm really interested in unpicking what it is that running releases in you and releases in your writing, and what drives you. I mean, you were talking about being exhausted at the end of a week and then going off on a long run. And right. Is it a kind of meditative process? Is it perhaps a daily prayer in a way?
It is. I mean, I again, you know, the disjunction between the West now and the East and the Far East and that, I mean, they've continued to have things like fasting, Ramadan, and a variety of things like this. When I grew up, those things were in place, even in the 70s, and fasting or fish on Friday and you know, going to the church at 6 o'clock in the morning, benediction and a variety of different prayers. I mean, I must have knelt down, you know, a million times during at the boarding school, prayer in the morning, lunchtime, and at night, vespers and all this. So I think when you have that and a sense of deprivation, I don't think anyone can really fool you. You know, you're kind of oriented toward yourself and a sense of struggle and just how short life is. And when I run over the years, there's no shortcuts. You know, everything is a physical challenge every single day. You kind of measure yourself in steps. And I think that reconstitutes any sense of grandeur. So when you say, you know, Booker Prize nominations or any of this type of stuff, you know, when you retreat from that and then you're alone for upwards of 2, you know, when I'm training hard, 4-hour runs alone, and it will go to remote locations, it just comes down to a very honed existence, where it's just a sense of what are your talents, what might you do when you come back to the so-called normal world, and then you kind of negotiate, you know, traversing that, like re-enter the world with something that you want to do, and then come back and evaluate yourself. And I think, again, the Christianity had that over the years, but it's been eclipsed very quickly.
Mm. So is running then part of the creative process? Are you thinking about your words as you run?
Initially, you know, there was no connection between running and writing. I mean, I just ran and I ended up realizing that I was a witness to things that people didn't see. So especially in ghettos in America, when I went on the scholarship, a beautiful campus, but no one would ever leave and run into other Rust Belt areas or into the ghetto areas. And so in a kind of naive way, I would just have to, for running 20 miles a day, negotiate these spaces. You're running fast, but you see it. You get a sense of the life and the kind of fear, and you see it in people's eyes. So then the last year of school, when I began to write stories, I began to realize, actually, all my understanding of the world has been through the act of running and the act of witness, without ever saying that you were out there to be a witness to it. So I think once I arrived at that kind of conscious decision, then running became the conduit to experiencing and then processing at the same time.
Mm-hmm. So do you think that you now run with writing in mind rather than writing being an accidental benefit of running? In terms of, I know you choose some really extreme locations. Is that done because you know this will make a great story?
Yeah, well, I mean, I've never written about the North Pole or the South Pole or anything like this, but I do think that I choose those journeys because it is an absolute disconnect. So from American politics at the moment, I wanted to get away from the Trump stuff. So, you know, I just finished a 600-mile run from Gros Ile. The people in 1847 came across, went to Gros Ile, quarantine island, 5,000 Irish died there, and then they traversed the St. Lawrence down to Toronto, 6,000 buried in Montreal in a mass grave. No one's ever built a memorial park to them. So in a situation like that, I wanted to, you know, put myself back in history and the displacement of people and get away from the kind of divisive politics that was going on in America. So in that month, you know, running and centering myself on history and also just the kind of physical challenge every single day, I decided I was going to blank out the modern world. I mean, you know, there was the Orlando shooting, there was the cop shootings, and I would see those tangentially, but sometimes I think all that stuff is just, you know, a great distraction, that I could pick out the kind of seminal events in a month and the tragic stuff that happened in Nice recently. It's not that I want to go away from it, but I still think that our own inner journey and our own sense of self, that some of these things are massive distractions to us. You know, there's just a litany of things over the years that we're asked to participate and understand, but sometimes it doesn't it doesn't mean something centrally to me in my own spirit. So I try to find that communication and that understanding of self through my relationship with myself.
I'm really interested to know how that works as a routine, as a you've got a long day of running ahead of you. How would you do that? Describe a running day to me.
Well, in this particular race or this run, you know, it's about 5:30 in the morning, get up. And I like to do things away from people. So, I mean, in some parts I was running through cities and that. But I like to be up early and like to see the emergence of the city, the kind of first people who are the underpinning of a society as they get up. Because I have great valour for people who are not seen and who are the kind of connective tissue. But, you know, it's simple. I mean, you get up, I'm so used to it, 3 hours of running. So, you know, it's done by 8 or so in the morning, and then that really reorients the rest of the day. I think there's always an element of fatigue and exhaustion that plagues you, but I like that. I think being too comfortable, too well fed, too well everything brings on a kind of a laziness. So to start the day with a sense of exhaustion, but I don't wear track shoes, I don't run around or trying to be and the athlete or say anything. I just like to have an element of exhaustion, which I think then gives you a heightened sense of just the world around you. You know, it's almost, you know, fight or flight, that kind of flight and fight instincts begin to come. You come back, your heart's racing, and you have to settle it down. There's exhaustion, you have to eat and you have to plan things. So it makes the day a very conscious effort after you do the running.
I'm reminded of ancient religious martyrs.
And I have to say, you know, if I had to do it all over again, I have 4 kids and that, and I got married when I was on my 22nd birthday, so married for 30-something years, that if I hadn't done that, I would have probably ended up being one of these people who stayed in America and then began to drift into the woods and become, you know, not a Ted Kaczynski, but if you know he is, the Unabomber. Yeah. But there's always that lure of leaving and getting distance from something. And it's become stronger as I've gotten older and as the world has, because there's more parsing of information and less understanding, but more information out there, that want to retreat and to kind of vicariously then come back has grown exponentially with the rise of, you know, the internet. And I was there at the beginning of the internet. You know, 92, 93, I'd worked on Mosaic and Netscape, and then I was hired at Microsoft to work on Internet Explorer. So I've kind of seen the thing that I despise, you know, that kind of proliferation of information and a kind of omniscient sense of everything around us, you know, I always thought, was that a good thing or a bad thing?
So you've pulled your kids out of school, or perhaps they've never been.
Right.
You live in a
motorhome. We have a house, but for much of the year, my daughter tragically had a brain tumor, benign brain tumor, but you didn't know for 2 years if it was growing or not. And that was another kind of a point in my life where I thought, I've worked at Microsoft, I've done all that type of stuff. Now I would like to give them a sense of dislocation, take them, not have the stigma of illness, not continue at school. So, I mean, she was only seven, but I said, you know, do you want to go to school? Do you want to go with me? Do you want to go out? You know, you can be educated. And so she wanted, my wife as well, decided that it would be better for us to, as a unit, just kind of experience what's out there in the actual world. And then that became, tragically through illness, it was another point of departure. And then with the other three kids that came along, you know, they went to school for formally to get you know, basic reading and writing down, but they all began to see the lure of let's go along down to the Gulf Coast, let's move up through California, let's go to the Redwoods, let's see these, you know, giant trees that a car can drive through. So their sense of seeing the world and exploring the world, you know, that I think that's an essential part of what I wanted to give them, which was, I think, is the gift of being an immigrant, which is there's no place called home. Everything is new and everything has some kind of shimmer to it and newness.
So how often do you move around, just on a practical
level? I'd say about 6 months. So I'm going back, going on a book tour to Australia. When I come back, then from October up to Christmas, we've planned to go down to Kentucky, Tennessee, and go down to Louisiana and go down through Texas. So I'd say about four months of the year we would be gone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this way of living, though, it seems to me can be done by two groups of people. One, the very poor who have no option.
Right.
And then the other are people who've managed to save up the resources and can afford just
right.
to quit society.
Yeah. And so that's what I actually up meeting. I mean, you go to what they call kind of white trash grounds where people live in trailers, and that's where you're pulling the motor home into, and then when you go running. So you really are seeing not the middle ground people, but the people who have nothing, or then say retirees would be the other class of people who are out there. And so they bring a certain conservative value. I mean, you think that they're kind of nomadic, but I mean, they're watching their resources, but they have money. So it's, you know, it's them, then it's the very desperate poor. And again, I think as a political writer, I'm always trying to understand the context of someone who's never going to make it. Like, and you begin to see in America sometimes that it rises with the emphasis on Trump and this, is that if someone begins to articulate the dissatisfaction of their life and says it's them, you know, it's immigrants, it's this, it's African Americans, you know, then they are able to kind of focus their sense of dissatisfaction with something and then vote for somebody like that. So if you don't articulate for them, then they're happy and they kind of go on with their lives and they can be very poignant or very debased lives. But if you can ever kind of politicize it and say, well, your life could be better, but it's because of these other influences that you are where you are, then all of a sudden there's a flashpoint. You can see those people become very aggressive and very incendiary.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that your books are offering an alternative way of understanding the world that we live in? And is that what you're setting out to do? Here's a different way.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, some people said, why don't you write a nonfiction book about your travels and try to articulate what we're chatting about here? I don't know if I'd ever want to do that and offer an alternative to people. But again, the books first and foremost are from myself, and I want to explain the world to myself and to my kids. But I do think that, again, when I come around here and see the size of hotel rooms, if you say in more modest hotels, I mean, the crunch of space, city living, everything, it just seems to be slightly aberrant to me that we end up living in tiny little quarters and there is no place to negotiate your own freedom. So I suppose that's the only reason I stay in America, is because of the kind of largeness of it.
So just before we go, really,
sure.
I wanted you to give us it's a hard thing to do, I
right.
know, but a snapshot of the death of all things seen.
All right, so there's one sense of American history which is very linear, goes from the Korean War forward with American greatness, or even further back to the benevolence of negotiating Indians and the first settlers over there, and then capitalism and commerce all takes place. And then by the time you get to 2008, all that kind of linear sense of progression that it's always going to get better is done. So this looks at America as it moves forward. There's never going to be a sense of greatness is around the corner. It's going to continue on that path. And I think that's always been part of the American psyche. So what do you do in a kind of post society where things aren't going to get better? How are the politics, how's everything going to reorient itself? So all the characters in it, I mean, a central gay man who's had a gay relationship and now he's reverting back to, you know, that he'll actually be with a woman. So, and they have a child, a legacy child from China. So they're cobbling things together. So there's no politics of sexuality around it. It's just really a politics of survival. So what you had in terms of your sexual orientation can be reevaluated and reprocessed in a relationship with somebody else. So partnerships, relationships come and go. That central character, again, as we talked about, leaves Chicago and then goes down into the not deep south, but down into Kentucky, Tennessee, again, where the Trump supporters come from. And you see another way of existence that's very different. So the entire novel is about that fractured sense of the world. And the central character has to go out and see that to come back to Chicago to understand that how he's going to proceed in life. But to stay where he is, I think would have killed him. He's a novelist, and so to really process the world. But I think it's not just the thing of a novelist, but to really understand the world, you have to go out and take these road trips and experiences.
Which is, of course, what you've done. How autobiographical is it then?
It's fairly autobiographical. I mean, I think that central character and voice that's very political is there in The Keepers of Truth, and it's always going to be a voice, but it's a central voice. But I do understand that it can get too political, and so it needs the balance of the other characters who are just kind of living in time and space and don't seem to have the kind of reflective sense of what he has. So my kind of challenge is to keep that central voice and not to have it to be dogmatic. But I am interested in it. When I read other novels and I see that there's no overt political quality to them, I'm always suspect about that you get lost in story and entertainment. And I think maybe books are probably the only last place where complex ideas can be played out. So I like the notion of social realism and the notion that what you're reading has a political, existential and philosophical point, and that's always going to be forefront in the book. So if I'm challenged on it, I say fine, because that's what I want to be forefront in it.
Mm. The Death of All Things Seen is out now.
Yes.
And it's published by Head of Zeus. Many, many thanks to you, Michael Collins. Thanks.
Lovely. Thank you very much for having me in.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website, from our app, from SoundCloud, MixCloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.